Okay, we're going to begin now. The topic for today is A Torah for the Ages, The Life and Times of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, or as many of the German descent call him, Shamshin Raphael Hirsch. And really, it's an exciting topic for me. This is a passion of mine, just to understand the history of our community, to the history of the Jewish community. And I think it's important for us, because if we understand our history, then we can understand how we got here in some better way. So we're really going to touch on just a little bit on each period that we're going to talk about in the course of Rav Shamshin Raphael Hirsch's life, and really the backdrop of his life and his work. And I got you a special gift, which you can take home with you, which is this packet. It's a very thorough packet. Don't be intimidated by it, because we're not going to read everything, but it is yours for the taking if you'd like. And it's really my gift to you that you can keep. So, you're welcome. Such a polite group. So,
Wait.
Just wait. Okay. Yeah. It should be said that everyone is encouraged to participate in the discussion. I would just I'll warn you that this is something of it could be like a black hole. We go into this period and there's so many things to talk about, but we'll try our best to keep, you know, sort of paced on the basic track of his lifetime. So some acknowledgments you'll see. I like to let everyone know where the sources come from. Is this just Rabbi Lesher's dreaming up these stories? Well, where does this come from? So I have a few articles here that I give credit to, a book or two, just so you can see. A lot of credit goes to these authors that did a great job at researching this topic. I happen to think that Rabbi Elio Meir Klugman's book, it's, I would say, one of the best art scroll biographies that was ever written. And it's very thorough and has footnotes, which are already, you know, not many of the books, the art scroll books have footnotes. I'm not sure why, but it's just, I always like to see they started putting out books with more footnotes. But I like to check my facts and see where this comes from. Okay, so before we understand Rabbi Hirsch, Rav Shamshin Raphael Hirsch, we have to really understand the context in which he lived and the conflicts that were going on at the time. It was a very turbulent time. He was born in the early 19th century, and this is really the backdrop of the 18th century, which in Europe was known as the time of the European Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Age of Reason. There are many different thinkers that promulgated the ideas of individuality and reason and logic, and anything that was seen as, you know, coming from the old, the shackles of oppression of the old guard and the, you know, traditions were generally thrown, or at least suspect, if not completely discarded. Anything that was, for sure, from a religious standpoint, many things were questioned. So the first thinker that we have to really understand, and we're really not going to do him justice today because he's really just in the background of our discussion, is Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn is born in 1780.
No, sorry.
No,
it's the wrong date.
It's the wrong date. He passes away. This looks like it's totally wrong because he's only alive for 3 years in this version.
1729.
Thank you very much. Does he pass away in
1786.
So both of those dates are wrong. Thank you so much. Okay. See, this is why we need the Genesovs and we need your participation. So 1729. Thank you very much. It does look very wrong there. 1729. It's a typo. I apologize. And he passes away in 1786. Now, a few myths about Moses Mendelssohn. First of all, Moses Mendelssohn did not found the Reform movement. He passes away about 30 years before the Reform platform even begins. He, like many thinkers, he was looked to by later thinkers to sort of give legitimacy or to give them sort of an intellectual legacy. Many of the members of the Enlightenment, the Jewish Enlightenment, also known as the Haskalah, look to the Rambam as well. No one thinks that the Rambam founded the Reform movement or the Haskalah, but they were looking for figures who would allow them to bridge the Jewish world with the Gentile world. And Moses Mendelssohn was a tremendous scholar. He was recognized by Kant. He was given a special dispensation to be allowed to live in Berlin, which was actually off limits to Jews at the time that he lived. And he was a tremendous scholar. Another myth that we have to dispel is that he was, let's say, Orthodox. Orthodox didn't even exist, but he wasn't observant. What Mendelssohn was 100% observant his entire life, what we would call today as frum. And it's really interesting. The legacy that he has is very controversial. It's right. Some people, you'll see in the first source over here that in the first few sources, there's a lot of discussion about who he was, what was his plan, what was his goal, how did he orient himself in this sort of, in this time period, which was a time that the Jewish people were allowed back into, or allowed into society, and it was a generally sort of a watershed moment, as we'll see. So, just to understand the backdrop of his life, we have the authoritative biography by Alexander Altman, and he writes that one of his well-known works was Jerusalem, and Jerusalem, he writes in source number one, is the work of a man who had achieved a unique and highly personal blend of rabbinic culture, in which he had grown up and continued to feel at home, and the European Enlightenment in which he had immersed himself with dazzling success. And as Altman points out, it's hard to really pinpoint, is he really trying to modernize Jewish thinking? Is he trying to give modern thought Jewish values? He's sort of in the middle. And that is what he says in source number two. He says, it cannot be doubted that Mendelssohn's profile emerges in distinct outline without any haziness or confusion. Some people say he was confused, he didn't know. Altman says no. He had a clear vision. And he writes, it is the profile of a man who lives up to the image that one would expect to find at the closing stage of a life steeped both in the Enlightenment and in Jewish tradition. He says he was a loyal Jew. He tried to create some sort of synthesis, some sort of unity in the different social circles that he was in. It was all held together for Mendelssohn within his philosophy. Now, what's sort of sad or tragic, or however you sort of wonder, was this his doing or was this factors outside of his control? But many of his grandchildren were baptized. As I mentioned, is a watershed moment because we could, part of this class we'll see, where did this go wrong? Like, it seems like he was completely observant, committed to the Torah, looking to see how Jews can be part of the world at large. I mean, it sounds like a regular 21st century Jew living in the modern world with a career and with aspirations and observance and Torah. So where did it go wrong? And you can see in 2017, Menachem Butler and Zev Elif, they have this it's really insightful article discussing sort of this dispute about his legacy and what he was and how do we see him. So they write that really Mendelssohn was really seen nowhere. He was not seen by either camp today as representing them. He says in source number three, the authors Butler and Elif, they write, the earnest Reformed Jew found him far too halachic, right? He was too traditional. The Orthodox, and we're talking about looking backwards, right? Because these terms didn't really exist at that time. As I mentioned, the Reform movement only started 30 years after he passes in 1783. And then, Orthodox was a response. So really, these terms didn't exist. But when we look back in history, So the Reform saw him too as too halachic. The Orthodox had more in common but steered clear of his loaded legacy. Mendelssohn was off limits. Despite his religious observance and noble efforts to engage Judaism with the modern world, Mendelssohn's memory was already far too tarnished and tangled with unseemly and untouchable notions like assimilation, heterodoxy, and secularism. Some may have considered his mission valiant, a reminder of their own struggle to maintain a religious balance in the shifty middle ground. Owing to all of this, though the Jews who occupied this precarious space sought out more pristine heroes, as we'll see Rav Shaul from Hirsch as an example, ones with far less baggage than the load weighing painfully upon Mendelssohn's shoulders. So Mendelssohn, sort of the way he depicts it, is they depict it as a tragic figure, almost with no continuity of what he tried to accomplish.
The word enlightenment.
Yes.
That's a period of time. Before him, was it already known?
So really with the French Revolution, we would generally, historians would, you know, we're superimposing these terms on years, so it's hard to really pinpoint where it is. But I think most say that, you know, with the French Revolution, with Napoleon, we've sort of started the age of the Enlightenment. There was a specific social circle called the Haskalah, mm-hmm. which is not a period, or I guess you could call it a period, and there were the Maskilim, who were the Jewish enlightened people, but a huge range. Some Maskilim, like Mendelssohn, maybe we call him a Maskil. Again, these terms are sort of, like I remember when I was in seventh grade, we learned social studies, and one of the things we learned about was just these general ideas. Mendelssohn's is Reform, we'll see soon, Zacharia Frankel and Heinrich Graetz, they were conservative. Shams Rivlahirsch was Orthodox. You know, these things didn't exist. Saying that these things, it's historically, we're trying to give words, place, you know, a period into the terms that we know. But the truth of the matter is that some Maskilim were very traditional. We would look at them as maybe modern Orthodox or something like that. That's part of this mixed legacy that Mendelssohn has. So Haskalah is sort of the period as well for the Jewish, or maybe even the Haskalah could be seen as a social circle. And the Maskilim are, you know, again, it really is a term for the enlightened ones. But as we'll see, it's a little more complicated. One of the main things that Mendelssohn devoted his life to was something that he called the Netivot Shalom, which we're going to see, a Sefer Netivot HaShalom, also known as the Biur or the Beyer, which was his translation of the Tanakh into German. And this was the first Bible, Jewish Bible translation into High German. And as we'll see, a lot of these theological debates, how much traditionalism should we keep? Should we throw everything away? Should we maintain our ground? A lot of these debates circle around Bibles, Chumashim, people putting out new translations, people giving rabbinic approbations, rescinding those approbations. So a lot of the history with this, a lot of the debate about this is actually the battleground is fought, these theological wars are fought over these translations. So this translation really was extremely controversial, but very, very well known. And he got many approbations from big name rabbis. And they gave letters of endorsement. Then later some of them pulled them back. So I wanted to show you, just so you could get a sense of what we're talking about. And you'll see when we get to Rav Hirsch's, the Pentateuch, his commentary on, or let me say, Der Pentateuch, his commentary on the Chumash, you'll see how he's responding or maybe modeling himself after, in some ways, some of the different Bibles at the time. So there was this renewed interest in the Jewish Bible, and you can see just in source number, take a look at source number 4, you can take a look and see, this is the Shmos, Chamishi Chumshi Torah, of a regular Mikros Gedolos, a regular from 1705, it just looks very similar to what we have today. You have, on the top right, you have the Psukim, on the top left, you have Unkelis. On the bottom, you have the Rashbam, Rashi, the regular commentaries. Now, take a look at what the Netivot, Sefer Netivot HaShalom did, known as the Bayer, Mendelssohn's work. So first of all, he keeps the regular psukim in the Hebrew on the right with the traditional targum on the left. Well, put it this way. It's a translation it's his own translation into German, but it is with Hebrew font. In other words, it's using a traditional semblance. It's keeping that semblance. It looks similar, even though it's his own translation, but it's what we would maybe call a transliteration, right? Using Hebrew letters to in German. Then he has at the bottom the Bayer, which are his summations and summary generally of the traditional commentaries. Now, he removes some of the regular commentaries, so in that way it's not traditional. Right, he's replacing the Targum Onkelos with his own Targum, his own translation. At the same time, you see that he does keep this sort of the model looks a little bit similar, and it's all in Hebrew, and we'll say it's all in Hebrew lettering. Okay, now take a look at source number 6 and 7. Compare 6 and 7. So. We'll do 7 first. 7 is, we're not going to do, I don't know German. I mean, I could make my way through it if I have the English translation as well. But this is Rav Hirsch, source number 7, his commentary of the Torah on Exodus from 1869. And you can see, first of all, he takes out, well, he leaves the psukim in Hebrew lettering, but you see the Gothic font is completely in German characters, right? He takes away the translation is not in Hebrew font, and the bottom is also in this German, his own German font. So both Rav Hirsch and Mendelssohn translate the Bible into German, and maybe you would even argue that Rav Hirsch is less traditional than Mendelssohn's because of the general font that he used. Now, according to Micha Gottlieb, one of the authors that I used for researching this topic, he wants to say that Rav Hirsch was actually, his commentary was an alternative to the Ludwig Philipson Bible. The Philipson Bible, which was, as you can see in source number 6, very similar layout, and it was a tremendously popular Bible translation. It was and Philipson at the time was one of the most successful leaders of the Reform movement. And in 1862, there were 100,000 Philipson Bibles in circulation. Now, think of that, before the modern technology that we have today, and they had a printing press, but, they were still using real, the mechanisms were much more clunky, and it was 100,000 is a lot. So according to Gottlieb, he thinks that Rav Hirsch was really an alternative to the Philipson Bible, who he saw as, problematic and for many reasons. Now, to understand, again, we mentioned, I'm going quickly, but we're just going to have to move on from Mendelssohn. Mixed legacy, what was his goal? We'll have to come back to maybe a different time in the future. But to understand what Rav Hirsch was responding to in his works, as I mentioned, many of these theological battles were waged in the commentaries on the Bible. We have to also understand what were the claims against traditional Judaism at the time. What were the popular notions at the time? So this is really the next section. I believe gives you a topic: the Protestant conception, letter of the law versus spirit of the law dichotomy. So you've probably heard people say, this is not the spirit of the law, this is just the letter of the law. You've probably heard that before. Now, just to understand what that means in 18th century Europe, it does not mean what we generally mean it to mean today, as, you have to understand the spirit, you have to, sort of go beyond just the letter of the law. In those times, just really also backing up into Christian debates, the Protestant Christianity was under, Protestant Christianity, going back to Luther, they were claiming that the sort of strict letter of the law of the Catholics and the traditional Christian approach was unlivable. That was what Luther claimed. And he was introducing the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law was seen as a livable tradition, and the letter of the law was seen as like a dead, unlivable type of theology. So they really would use this, and this is going back much earlier to Luther's time, but the reform and also the just general zeitgeist of the time was to use this as a critique of anything really that they didn't like. Oh, this is just the dry letter. This is the dry letter of the, this is the old way that you'll see this also written about a lot in, about the Talmud. You know, I remember when I was at the Siyum HaShas, right before COVID, right, I think it was 2020, and Rav Yisachar Friend, if you haven't seen his speech at the Siyum HaShas, definitely recommend you listening to it. It's really incredible. And he said that in the records of Nazi Germany, they talk about the from Jews not as Orthodox, but as Talmud learners, that they learned Talmud. They were Talmud learners. And you see that there was this reputation that the Orthodox Jews had of being devoted to this book called the Talmud. And that's why he spoke about it at the Siyum HaShas, at the Daf Yomi Siyum HaShas. So the claim was that Talmud was clinging to this old dead letter of the law. And the Enlightenment, the Haskalah, and the Maskilim were generally more interested in Bible study, because the Bible was seen as more of the spirit of Judaism, whereas, and I'm oversimplifying now, but just generally was seen as the spirit of Judaism, whereas the Talmud and Halacha was seen as the subjugation and the old, dead, dry Judaism of the old. People just sitting there, you know, you see in Graetz's biography, he writes about when he learned, we'll see about him soon, Heinrich Graetz, wrote the very well-known History of the Jews. He was when he was a student, he read the 19 Letters, which was Hirsch's first work. He was so inspired, he came to study with Rav Hirsch. And he writes about what they studied, and in one of the parts in the biography, he says this man was just sitting over these old tombs of the Talmud and the codes. It was wasting his time. Like, he didn't understand, you know, that it's one big picture, that the Talmud's part of Judaism. He was frustrated with Rav Hirsch's traditionalism, and eventually they parted ways. But they studied together for, I believe, three years. So this dichotomy of the spirit and the letter is really not what we mean today. It's a different type of critique. It's this old, rigid, dead type of living. Now, if you want to look and see this, how Rav Hirsch is responding, Gottlieb points this out. This is right from Micha Gottlieb. He says, look at the 19 letters. And you have in translation actually from 1899, in source number 8 from Bernard Drachman. He writes in letter 1, this is, just to give a little background, anyone heard of the 19 letters? Yeah, the 19 letters. So the 19 letters was actually originally written as a summary of Chorev. So Rav Hirsch wrote many works. And just to give a little bit of a background in his works before we talk about the 19 letters, so he wrote this large work called Chorev, really I think he called it Moriah. And he went to a publisher and he, like I said, you know, I have this whatever it was, a 600-page, whatever it was, a big manuscript. And the publisher's like, you know, not a Jewish publisher. He said, why don't you come back with a shorter draft and we'll see how that does. And if it does well, so then, you know, we'll go ahead with the big work. You know, so good advice in general, probably. So he publishes anonymously. It was, you know, not even his name, but he sent out this, he gave him the 19 letters, and he published it, and it was very, and the 19 letters of Ben Uziel, it was very well received, and then later he publishes Chorev. So the 19 letters are really a summary of his overall thought, and we'll see throughout his writings, he'll come back to these different themes, which we've already seen in the 19 letters, but as you will see clearly, much more, I don't want to call it apologetic, but you'll see he's responding to some of the claims against the Orthodox Judaism much more, you know, forcefully once he's writing later in his life, when he's writing his commentary on the Torah. And we shall see very clearly where he's responding. So in letter one of the 19 letters, just a spoiler alert, it's one letter of the, it's really a dialogue between two friends, Naphtali and Binyamin, and one of them is basically a maskil, questioning, not religious any longer, and the other one is this rabbi, and they used to be friends. So the first letter is written by, I always get mixed up who's who, but I believe it's Naphtali. Leon's going to help us out again. No. But basically, the first letter is the critique, and then the next 18 are all defense. There's no. I was always waiting. When's the response going to come? The counter response. So he has one letter, letter one, which is all the critiques. So you may think you'll see some of this, but you may think, okay, all these critiques, Rav Hirsch is not going to give any credence to that. He's just going to respond and, you know, sort of wipe the floor with this individual. It's not the case. He actually accepts a lot of the critiques, which we shall see. So let's look at source number 8. Anyone want to volunteer to read it? Nobody? Okay, Elaine's going to read it. Source number 8.
Robbed of all the characteristics of nationality, we are nevertheless deemed a nation, and every one of us is by his very birth doomed to form an additional link in this never-ending chain of misery. The law is chiefly at fault for all of this, by enjoining isolation in life, and thereby arousing suspicion and hostility, by breaking the spirit through inculcation of humble submissiveness, thereby inviting contempt, by discouraging the pursuit of informative arts, by dogmas which bar the way of free speculation, and by removing to the separation in life every incentive to exertion in science and art, which therefore do not flourish among us.
Okay, we'll hold it there. We'll hold it there. So, do we see any themes there that strike us as familiar? Peter?
Well, obviously they're almost scared of change.
Right. That's true, 100%. Submissiveness and, we don't want to change things. But you see that he's using the same terminology they've broken their spirit through this inculcation of this contemptful living and not to go into the arts. Meaning, he's talking about the idea of, the never-ending chain of misery of the Jew is just to be submissive, to hold by, we would make maybe call it, you'll see, the letter of the law, which is more clear in the next source, we shall see. But let's just, I'm going to read a little bit from this article from Gottlieb, where he quotes different passages as well from the 19 letters. He says, and I mentioned this before, one may be inclined to interpret Hirsch as presenting these criticisms without endorsing them. Right, he's saying, I'm not endorsing the fact that the Jews never-ending chain of misery, and we are submissive to the law, and we don't have any enjoyment of life and spirit, and we're just totally, dead. He's like, but that's actually not the case. Continuing in the source, but in letter 17, after he has presented his ideal of Judaism, the rabbi concedes that you will find that the shrines that we still have to make, and distances that will separate us from reaching this ideal are great indeed. And then he goes on and is surprisingly sympathetic to the reformers. He writes, do not be angry with them, for they sense a shortcoming. He continues, he says a very clever line, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. He says, by all means reform. Reform the Jews by elevating them to the ideals of Judaism properly understood, but not by reforming Judaism. So, sort of Hirsch here, then he goes on to say that, this is using citations from Rav Hirsch, educational considerations are central in, I'm not going to say this right, Neizen brief, but it's the 19 letters, and Hirsch has Benjamin Voice, the complaint that Talmud study is arid theoretical exercise, disconnected from life that confuses the mind and leads it astray into subtleties and minutiae of petty distinctions. Once again, Hirsch agrees with many of Benjamin's critiques. So Benjamin's the critic, and Naphtali is the response, right? The rabbi responding. But he doesn't necessarily disagree. And he says that it's true, Talmud study often occupies itself with dialectical hair splittings. So what really is happening here is, why is there so much critique of the Talmud? And why are we talking about these ideas of, we need to reform Judaism. I'm sorry, we need to reform Jews, not Judaism. Because we've sort of lost our way and understanding of what the spirit of the Torah is. That's a sort of a summary. And this is what he actually says in letter number 2 in Rav Tully's response. He says, why do we have to read the Torah in Hebrew? Rav Hirsch says, we have to read the Torah in Hebrew. Interestingly, he translates it into German, but he's explaining the original etymological sources. That's what he really spends a lot of time doing in his parish, his explanation. He says, we must also read the Torah in Hebrew. That is to say, in accordance with the spirit of that language. Similar language, again, the spirit of the Torah as opposed to the letter. Source number 11, further in Gottlieb. Hirsch distinguishes between the biblical letter and the Talmudic spirit. So here we'll see, this is also found in the 19 letters, where he says that the biblical letter is sort of the written Torah. But what gives the Torah its spirit? That's through the oral Torah. That's through the tradition that was passed down from Sinai. He says, the Torah Sheba al Peh, the oral Torah, is detailed explanation above all the spirit of the Bible's teachings, which were to be perpetuated by the living word. Finally, the spirit of the Tanakh and the Gemara was written in Agadah, right, the non-halakhic parts of the Talmud, but in a veiled form which required active investigation to penetrate its spirit with the help of the inherited oral tradition. So the oral tradition for Rev Hirsch in the 19 letters is to unravel and to bring out the special live Torah. The written Torah is sort of, it's just the text. It's not alive. He's responding to the critique that Judaism is dead. The Talmud learners, what are they? They're just submissive and following this old chain of misery that they're just not questioning, just doing and doing. They don't know what the reasons are. We need to reform those Jews. We need to bring them, almost you call that, enlighten them. Bring them the spirit of the Torah. Where is the spirit of the Torah found? Not in the words, but rather in the oral tradition, which we have now is written down, but it was always in an oral tradition. There is a shift, which I mentioned to you before, in Rav Hirsch's writings in the 19 letters, in his early writings, and then later on in his Der Pentateuch, his commentary on the Torah, which Gottlieb traces. And he has a certain theory about it, but there's clearly a change, you'll see. The change is, as we mentioned, Rav Hirsch is really responding to much of the, this is post Mendelssohn, responding to much of the critiques of his time. So to go through just a few of them, and we'll see how Rav Hirsch responds, and then we'll have to probably call it a day. So one of the characters we should know about, two of the characters of the time that Rav Hirsch explicitly responds to in the collected writings. They didn't call them that. He didn't call his writings the collected writings then. But later they were translated and brought into the collected writings. Two of the characters were Zacharia Frankel and Heinrich Graetz. Zacharia Frankel was he was very critical of the Reform movement. He felt that Abraham Geiger, who was really one of the major founders of the Reform movement, he was making too many changes, too many drastic alterations, too many reforms, and he started this his own movement, or maybe we could call it, initially it was his own work, and it has now been termed the positive historical, positive historical camp, and later, you could see why a lot of people say this, but people say this was a precursor to the conservative movement. Conservative movement really was started much later in the United States. But one of the things that Frankel argues is that we have to keep our traditions, but not because necessarily they came from Sinai. This is what Rav Hirsch in his writings uncovers and sort of in a lengthy article really blasts Frankel. What he claims is that Frankel does not believe in Torah Mesinai. But interestingly, there were many great rabbis and one of them was Rav Shlomo Rappaport, who was son-in-law of the Ketzos HaChoshen. He supported Frankel, but Hirsch claims that Frankel really denied the authenticity of Torah Misinai, of Torah coming from Sinai, and believed that tradition's very old. It's very ancient. We have to continue it because it's very old, and there's many historical reasons. Positive refers to the fact that it's, this is the heart of Judaism, and the law is the heart of Judaism. And historical was that he was believed in this version of the historicity of these interpretations of the Jewish law. And that brought in human agency, and their, so they're a piece in the puzzle. But Rav Hirsch felt that he was, although saying that Judaism, we keep the law and it's historical, but it was mostly how he characterized Frankel. It was the rabbis were sort of creating the laws, and they're very old and they're very ancient, and we have to keep them, but they weren't really from Sinai. So that, according to Rav Hirsch, was completely need to be rejected. And he writes that Frankel's understanding of this historical version of the oral tradition, how it sort of developed through human initiative, was denying the timeless truth of the Torah. And you can see what he writes here in a very, I would say, this is just a small selection of what he writes in Volume 5, which is in the Collected Writings. Volume 5 is a long article where he critiques Frankel. And he writes here in source number 12, "Truly, if we were to perceive these men, our great transmitters of the law, whom Frankel considers the generators," in other words, they're not transmitting a law that came from Sinai, but rather they're generating the law, "the producers and creators of our practical religious law, then we must consider them as Machiavellians," which according to Wikipedia is a psychological trait centered on interpersonal manipulation, unemotional coldness, and indifference to morality. In other words, why would we care what these rabbis who made up a religion, why would we care what they said? And we'd have not value anything they have taught us. In other words, if you believe, like Frankel does, that it was a what we call historical, positive historical approach, that these are old laws that these rabbis sort of created with great wisdom, but they were human inventions, we wouldn't care what they have to say because they don't have any bearing on our life. If we don't relate to them, if we do relate to them, great. If we don't, then we will discard them. So Rav Hirsch saw that it was really important, this question of the oral law. What's the status of the oral law? This was really a focus in that time, and Frankel was really, according to Rav Hirsch, questioning this. And therefore, if you see, I'm going to skip number 13 just because we mentioned this before, that Rav Hirsch is responding to biblical criticism in his commentary on the Torah, even though he doesn't say it explicitly. But you'll see direct responses that Rav Hirsch has to these theories of the, we're not going to question that the Torah should be chsav, the written Torah, that comes from Sinai. But this oral tradition, the Talmud and other things, that was an invention of the rabbis. So if you look at source number 14, Rav Hirsch writes that the sages themselves sharply marked their man-made laws and differentiated them from the actual God-made laws of the Torah. In other words, when the rabbis are giving us laws that are rabbinic, that are man-made, they tell us. They want to make it very clear. This is a rabbinic enactment. Purim, Hanukkah, right? Those are rabbinics. But the rabbis derived the 39 halachos. It doesn't say anywhere explicitly in the Torah. But they are interpreting the Torah using their tradition and bringing us back to Sinai. So how does that work? The rabbis are telling us their interpretation, but it has the level of godly divine law. So that's what Rav Hirsch is very busy with in his commentary, because he's trying to give a rationale that will be palatable to the people of his time and that will combat and to respond to the claims of the let's call it the Frankel's claim that this is a rabbinic Judaism. This is just rabbis making up the laws. So another example where he's responding to this is the case of in Mishpatim. Parshas Mishpatim is very interesting. Right after Yisro, when we had the revelation at Sinai. We have Parshas Mishpatim. What do we begin with? So Rav Hirsch says, we're transitioning from an expression of service to God through creating the Mishkan, creating the altar and the idea of service. And then we're going to transition to creating a just and moral humane society. Ve'ela ha-mishpatim, that's what the Vav means. We're continuing, Revelation continues with the just society that we're going to build. That's why the Mishpatim, which mean laws, is so fundamental. But the question is, where does this begin? The way that we start off this new society is when a person sells another person as a slave, or if he sells his daughter as a slave. That is the most, first of all, it's not going to always happen. So first of all, it's very not standard. And reverse says it doesn't make any sense. It's not giving us the grand scheme of the vision of this moral society. So reverse says, you look at this in source number 16, his commentary on this, on these psukim, he signe eved ivri, the eved ivri, the Jewish slave, to the unprejudiced mind. Now, who is he talking about? Not to those who are prejudiced with, again, he's not naming them explicitly, but the people who he thinks have gotten it wrong. Nothing can show so strikingly the truth of the traditional oral law as the first two paragraphs. And he explains, right, when a man sells another man, or if he sells his daughter as a slave, they show us the truth of the oral law. What? What is he talking about? So he says as follows. He says, these cases are exceptional. And it is these sentences, the context of which deny and limit the very holiest personal right of a man to the right of a person of freedom, becoming a slave. That's where we begin. Why? Because this book is not the real source of the Jewish conception of rights. It's not the source. This book is only to be an aid to memory and reference. And then, look down in the third paragraph. He says, the Torah Shebichsav is to be, so the Torah Shebapeh, the written Torah to be the oral Torah, in relation of short notes, we would say the cold notes, of the full and extensive lecture on any scientific subject. Now, we see, first of all, before we read this together, Rav Hirsch is totally leaving behind his spirit and law dichotomy, which we said came from the sort of the Christian world. He's not saying that the oral law brings the spirit of the Torah. He doesn't even mention spirit at all. He is now communicating a very different message, which we'll see. And that message is going to be in direct response to those who have, he's talking to the unprejudiced mind, but he's implying there are prejudiced minds out there that would see this as a clear indication how this is the old written Torah. It has no relationship to our lives, and therefore, you know, we could clearly see that all these laws that are nowhere to be found in the Torah, all the laws that they claim, these rabbis claim, you got all these davening and kosher and all these things, like, right, all these, thank you so much. Baruch Ata Adonai Elohim Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyah Bevaro. All these things that the rabbis claim is what Orthodox Judaism is, are not in the Torah. So that's what he's responding to. And he's saying, no, the true source of our tradition is not the written Torah. It's actually the oral Torah. This is what he says. The oral Torah, that's the lecture. That's the actual teaching of the let's say, in a university, that's the teacher. It's a mashal. Obviously, God is not a teacher. But we see him as giving this lecture. And what is the Torah Shebichsav? It's really counterintuitive. You'd think of, okay, so you have the written notes of the lecture, and then you have all the rabbis extrapolating and making things up, and that would be like what Hirsch would say, Frankel is claiming. But no, Hirsch flips it on its head, and he says the opposite is the case. The Torah Shebichsav is just the little, he calls them the short notes, which for the learned student are quite sufficient to bring back afresh to his mind at any time the whole subject of the lecture. For him, a word, an added mark of interrogation, exclamation, a dot, an underlining of a word is often quite sufficient to recall to his mind a whole series of thoughts. That's why if you learn Gemara or you learn Midrash, you see, oh, this word is said like that, and that means this, and this word said like that. What are you crazy? That's what Hashem want. That's how Hashem wants us to understand His Torah, through a little word with a little check under there. No, the verse is saying, because you don't understand. These are the short notes. These are the little reminders. But there's a much bigger lecture that happened. The lecture at Sinai, and we have these little reminders. And he clearly says, if you're the initiated, if you know of this tradition, then you know that we're not producing the laws. We're not producing them, right? These notes are not where we get these laws from. They're just the records. They're the, according, this is Gottlieb's terminology, the written trace for the oral law. Or the written trace for the oral, sorry, what is it? The oral word, right? Something like that? I wrote it down in the source sheet. One of the sources is the oral letter and the written trace. The oral letter and the written trace. In other words, really the oral Torah is the fundamental one, is the primary one, and the written Torah is sort of the traces of that oral law. Now you see a completely different point here. It doesn't talk about the spirit or the law, the spirit and the law dichotomy. So it could be he's broken away from this old way of thinking about it, or both, he's responding to those who claim that there's a bifurcation between the oral and the written, as we just explained at length, that the rabbis are making this up, and refers to saying, no, the opposite is the case. We have these traditions. We have little traces of it. We have little hints to it. Those aren't the production of those laws. Those are the little handwritten notes of the lecture. Okay. A few more things. I'm just going to touch briefly on something that was controversial at the time, but I don't think it's really so controversial anymore, but that is the following. So Rav Hirsch was very open to the failings of biblical heroes. Unlike some of the other thinkers of his time, he actually thought that when the Torah records the mistakes of our biblical heroes, it actually gives a lot more credence to the Torah. Let's see where he says that. And again, it's all going back to this question of the authentic, real, genuine Torah Misinai. So, Rav Hirsch writes in source number 17, "The Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weaknesses of our great men. Just by that, in other words, just by writing those things, and we'll see some examples soon, it gives a stamp of veracity." In other words, what tradition that is man-made is going to recall the mistakes of its great heroes? That is not usually how a tradition would want to impress you. If it wants to be impressive, it'll just say, oh, how great these people were. They were almost like angels, and you should be like them. You know, Rav Hirsch is saying, no. And you see, I don't know if he's looking for it or he feels the need to explain it, but he's responding to those people who claim that this is, this is written by human beings. And he's saying, no, we see the opposite is the case. If this was written by humans, they'd try to cover it up. We know about people who try to cover things up and mistakes that happen. We're talking about the Avos. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. We're talking about not people who, okay, so he, you know, it was very, to reverse, very clear. Again, that this was a sign that the Torah was historically God's written word, as we saw, the written trace, but it was God's word nonetheless. And he writes at the end of this quotation in translation, "The Torah is not a collection of examples of saints. It relates what occurred not because it was exemplary, but because it did occur." In other words, there's a historical truth. Another piece that Rav Hirsch clearly shows him open to criticizing or understanding the Torah's critique of its own heroes is Rivka and Yitzchak raising Yaakov and Esav. He says, how do you have a Yaakov and an Esav that come out of the same home? I mean, every child's different, and he almost like takes it as a given. You raise children differently. He says Yaakov and Esav had parents who didn't understand that. Which parents are you talking about? Rivka and Yitzchak, our great matriarch and patriarch. He says, for them, both Yaakov and Esav had the same chinuch, the same educational treatment. The great law of education, of chanuch lenar al pidarko, bring up each child in accordance with its own ways, was forgotten. In other words, they didn't understand, and he claims that Yitzchak was more attracted to the opposite, which was Esav. He was a man who didn't understand, you know, here's a man who didn't really understand this world, and he sees his son, wow, he's so powerful, he's so active, and therefore he was attracted to that. And Rivka, he claims, was more you know, understanding or attracted to the opposite. But he says explicitly, had Yitzchak and Rivka studied Esav's nature and character early enough and asked themselves, how even in Esav, how can all this strength and energy, agility and courage that lie slumbering in this child be won over to be used in the service of God? But they didn't. And he's saying that was a mistake. And he's saying that was a mistake, but he doesn't explicitly then go and tie it back to what we saw before he did. But you see that the mistakes that are made, according to our verse, that are made in the Torah by our heroes is another proof of the divinity of the Torah. So, a very different Hirsch. We saw he was open to the critiques of the reformers, much more open earlier in his career than later. It could be he saw, like we mentioned before, he saw the writing on the wall, he saw the failings of the previous maskilim, and he felt compelled to respond very strongly. We don't know. But we do see a different voice, right? The voice in the 19 letters is the voice in the 19 letters is definitely a voice of, you know, he's critiquing, but he's sort of, in a way, also critiquing the old ways of Judaism as well. Reform the Jews who are sort of stuck with this limited, or we talked about the written letter without understanding the spirit of the law. But then later on, in the Chumash, in his Der Pentateuch, his commentary on the Torah, he very much emphasizes in different places that the oral Torah is actually the fundamental. They're both in the 19 letters and in the commentary on the Torah. They're both fundamental for different reasons, and responding very strongly that really that was the lecture, and the written Torah was just sort of the traces of that lecture, but that the written Torah is almost secondary. Whereas earlier on, he was trying to say that the spirit of the Torah is brought out, but it's really the spirit of the Torah. So there's a lot more to be said, but it's 3 o'clock. We'll hold it over here, and we'll continue to study this time period. And as I mentioned, I'm hoping to continue this maybe as part of some adult ed series, because it's important for us to understand. I think we should do a history series to understand where we are now. We have to understand where we come from. And refers to just one part of the story. It's a very there's a lot more there. And as mentioned, someone has an interest in Rav Kook, so we'll hopefully eventually get there. It'll take us 100 years, but not 100 years, but we'll see.